This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verses 9 to 11 of chapter Hud from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Sayyid Ahmad Mirzadeh Waqifi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ مِنَّا رَحْمَةً ثُمَّ نَزَعْنَاهَا مِنْهُ ولئن أذقناه نعماء بعد ضراء مسته ليقولن ذهب السيئات عني إنه لفرح فخور إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير. صدق الله العلي.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. And if we make man taste mercy from us, then take it off from him, most surely he is despairing, ungrateful. And if we make him taste a favor after distress has afflicted him, he will certainly say, "The evils are gone away from me." Most surely, he is exulting, boasting. Except those who are patient and do good, they shall have forgiveness and a great reward.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines. Tunisia's president orders a night curfew until late August after ousting the country's prime minister and suspending parliament. The U.S. Defense Secretary expresses deep concern about the alarming spike in suicides among American troops. And Australia's New South Wales faces extension of coronavirus-related restrictions as its daily new cases spikes to a 16-month peak. Welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Nias. Thanks for joining us. Tunisian President Kais Saied has hit back at his critics over the sacking of the country's prime minister and the suspension of parliament, saying that his actions were according to the constitution.
Some have talked yesterday about a coup. I don't know in which law or political sciences school they studied. How can a coup be based on the constitution? This is an implementation of the constitutional script. Article 80 of the Constitution gave the President of the Republic the right to take the procedures he sees necessary in the face of an imminent danger.
Saied called on Tunisians to remain calm and not to respond to any provocations, asking them to take to the streets. He has ordered a night curfew until late August. The President also sacked the Defense Minister one day after ousting the Premier and suspending Parliament. Meanwhile, dismissed Prime Minister Hichem Mechichi has promised to hand over power to the president as he chooses his replacements, saying that he does not want to be a disruptive element. President Saied's sacking of the country's top officials prompted street clashes outside of the army-barricaded parliament, plunging the country into a political crisis.
Clashes have erupted between supporters of Tunisian President Kais Saied and proponents of the ruling Ennahda party outside the parliament amid a months-long political crisis in the African nation. The rival rallies took place after Parliament Speaker Rashid Ghannouchi urged people to take to the streets. This followed Saied's Sunday decision to invoke the Constitution to dismiss Prime Minister Hichem Mechichi and freeze the parliament for 30 days. The president, however, said the 30-day period could be extended if needed and that he would govern alongside a new premier. Ghannouchi condemned the move as a coup.
Today we are surprised by supreme decisions that not only surprise another, but also surprise the Tunisian people and the world in a country that is proud of being the first Arab democracy and having the latest constitution, announcing decisions that are essentially a coup d'etat, and it's called nothing but a coup.
Ghannouchi also led a sit-in protest in front of the parliament after the army blocked him from entering the legislature building following the president's order. There were mixed reactions in Tunisia to Said's decision.
Regarding this decision, it's the first time in my life I have heard a head of a state take a correct decision. We have taken back our country. This is the first time I have gone out to the streets to celebrate.
The decisions by President Kais Saied are not correct, against the constitution and the reality. They bring us back again to 1954. The scene of the parliament closed by tanks is very disgraceful.
The president and the assembly of the representatives of the people of Tunisia were elected in separate popular votes in 2019, while Meshishi took office last year. His fragile government lurched from crisis to crisis as it struggled to deal with the coronavirus pandemic and the need for urgent reforms amid his political disputes with Said. Said's move to dismiss the government and freeze parliament followed mass demonstrations in several Tunisian cities earlier on Sunday. The protesters demanded the government's removal amid a weeks-long spike in COVID cases and the devastating impact of the pandemic on the country's already ailing economy. However, the president's decision has posed the greatest challenge to the country since its 2011 revolution, which ousted longtime ruler Zainul Abidine Ben Ali. Over the past decade, the country has faced a series of challenges, such as terrorism, which has choked the country's vital tourism sector and contributed to an economic decline.
The U.S. President Joe Biden and the Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Qasimi have reached an agreement on formally ending the presence of American combat forces in the Arab country by the end of 2021.
I think things are going well. Our role in Iraq will be as a dealing with not, it's just to be available to continue to train, to assist, to help, and to deal with ISIS as it arrives. But we are not going to be by the end of the year in a combat mission.
The announcement was made during the first face-to-face meeting between Biden and Qasimi at the White House as part of a strategic dialogue between the two leaders. Biden said, however, that the U.S. counterterrorism operation will continue, even after shifting to a new phase. The Iraqi resistance groups, however, have time and again stressed that all American troops must leave the country. The U.S. invaded Iraq in 2003 over the allegation of possession of weapons of mass destruction by then-Iraqi ruler Saddam Hussein, but such weapons were never found. Washington redeployed its troops to the Arab country years later under the pretext of fighting the Daesh terror group. Political commentator Scott Bennett says the fact that some U.S. troops are allowed to stay in Iraq is because of the lobbying and interests of the U.S. military-industrial complex, as well as Israeli intelligence services.
It's only in the interest of the military-industrial complex, the mercenaries, the Mossad, the professionals that make bombs and bullets and missiles, and this is precisely why they're trying to stay there. They're trying to keep a foothold in Iraq. But I think the Iraqi people have spoken up. The Iraqi people have said, we do not want American mercenaries in our country. And I think they also recognize this is a failed terror attempt that started in 2001 under the great false flag events of 9/11, where the U.S. thought that it could expand its military hold on places like Afghanistan, Libya, Syria, Iraq, and with ultimate ambitions on Iran. So they may have still be suffering under this delusion that they can maintain troops in Iraq for operations against Iran. But I think even that is very quickly dimming. We're witnessing that the world has woken up. They're rejecting the Western imperial presence.
The U.S. Defense Secretary has expressed deep concern over the alarming spike in suicides among American forces. Lloyd Austin said the Pentagon is working hard to tackle the problem, and there's still a lot to do. Last year, 385 active-duty American soldiers died by suicide. That made a steep increase from 326 cases reported by the Pentagon in 2018. According to the U.S. Defense Department, stress factors for troops include the unpredictability of life in the military. As a case in point, troops stationed in Alaska encountered harsh weather conditions. They face geographic and social isolation, as well as frequent training and deployment. Soldiers also face high costs of living, prevalent alcohol abuse, and sleep disorders. Australia's most populous state of New South Wales faces an extension of coronavirus-related restrictions after new cases surged to a 16-month high. New South Wales reported 172 new infections Tuesday. That is up from 145 cases one day earlier. In response, the local government said that the 5-week lockdown of the state could be further extended. A final decision is expected later this week. More than half of Australia's nearly 26 million population has been under a lockdown in recent weeks. It followed an outbreak of the highly infectious Delta variant in New South Wales' capital, Sydney, and has spread to three other states. Australia has so far recorded over 33,000 COVID cases and 920 deaths from the pandemic. The number of people contracting COVID-19 in EU countries continues to rise sharply. The Delta variant of the virus, first identified in India, is the main driver of health and economic concerns in the 27-nation bloc. Jerome Hughes reports.
More and more people in the EU are congregating indoors. The highly contagious Delta variant of COVID-19 is spreading like wildfire in countries like France and Spain. More people are also travelling within the EU. Citizens in Brussels have been sharing their thoughts on the Delta variant.
I don't know where the cases come from, if it's a coffee restaurant or just meeting in our house.
When I see how people are behaving sometimes, I'm not surprised.
The European Central Bank, which manages the euro, says economic confidence is being undermined.
The pandemic continues to cast a shadow, especially as the Delta variant constitutes a growing source of uncertainty.
On Monday, EU finance ministers rubber-stamped COVID-19 recovery funding for four additional nations in the 27-country bloc.
Croatia, Cyprus, Lithuania and Slovenia. Now more than half of national plans is adopted.
However, critics say the billions of euro being administered to national governments will result in citizens being saddled with decades more austerity because there is too much emphasis on loans rather than grants. According to analysts, EU leaders are harming the bloc's economy through their foreign policy. Sanctions are inhibiting trade. Economists say the Iranian market represents a big opportunity. It can be availed of if current efforts to save the JCPOA Iran nuclear deal succeed. We have been speaking to the head of the European Parliament's Iran delegation about the subject via Skype. She believes the agreement will be reinstated soon.
Many people in Iran say, again and again and again, we have not a good partner on this side. This is one of the impacts of this horrible, stupid policy of Trump.
The International Labour Organization, ILO, warns an additional 25 million jobs could be lost globally before the end of this year due to the coronavirus. However, the ILO says if we see an internationally coordinated policy response, the number of people losing their jobs could be much lower. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has called for the renegotiation of the post-Brexit trade deal between London and the European Union. Johnson has rejected EU offers to resolve disagreements over post-Brexit arrangements for Northern Ireland. He said the offers are insufficient. Johnson has insisted that comprehensive and durable solutions are needed to address the existing problems. London wants key changes in the trade deal that it signed with Brussels last year in the wake of its departure from the bloc. Northern Ireland is a hot issue as it, in effect, stays in the EU's single market. The UK says that the issues will be settled only if its demands are met. North and South Korea have agreed to restore cross-border communication lines that were severed more than a year ago. The decision is the first step of an agreement between leaders of the two countries to improve ties. That's according to a statement by the South Korean presidential office. It said, to that aim, President Moon Jae-in and the North's Kim Jong-un have exchanged personal letters since April. Seoul said the two leaders also agreed to restore mutual trust as soon as possible. North Korea's official news agency has confirmed the announcement. The North cut off all official military and political communication links with the South in June of last year. It did so after activists sent anti-Pyongyang leaflets across the border. Frank Smith says the restoration of communication lines between the two Koreas shows the North's willingness to engage with the international community.
So this step by North Korea isn't just a coming out to the South. It's a message to the United States that it wants to enter into some type of broader dialogue over other outstanding issues, in particular the United Nations Security Council sanctions against North Korea over its nuclear weapons programs. North Korea likely will want to see that develop into negotiations for arms control. And the U.S. and its allies are sticking to this idea of complete denuclearization, which is really kind of off the table. But again, looking at this in a broader perspective, it shows that North Korea is reaching out now, that it's willing to engage in the international community, not just South Korea.
Hundreds of Hungarians have rallied in the capital, Budapest, against the government's alleged use of Israeli-made Pegasus spyware. The protesters marched to the headquarters of the ruling Fidesz party with some chanting slogans against the Prime Minister Viktor Orban. Protests erupted after Hungarian media outlets said that the government has used Israeli spyware to keep under surveillance journalists, businessmen, lawyers, and anti-government critics. However, the government maintains that it has carried out intelligence-gathering operations lawfully. The Pegasus spyware was reportedly used to target journalists and activists across dozens of countries, as well as prominent heads of state, including the presidents of France and Iraq and the King of Morocco. The Israeli warplanes have launched a series of raids on separate targets in the Gaza Strip. Israel says the airstrikes came in response to the recent launching of incendiary balloons from Gaza. Palestinians view the firing of the balloons as a form of defending their rights. Ruba Shabit has more.
Israeli warplanes carried out airstrikes early Monday on positions in the Gaza Strip in response to incendiary balloons fired from Gaza. Palestinians say these balloons are a means to pressure the Israeli regime to respond to their demands and lift the siege imposed for 15 years, deteriorating the life of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip.
Israeli airstrikes are part of efforts by Israel to undermine the Palestinian resilience and increase the suffering of Palestinians. These airstrikes show the weak position of the Israeli army. The Israeli regime is linking the reconstruction in Gaza to political issues, including the fate of its soldiers in Gaza, and we won't accept this. The ongoing blockade and restrictions will lead to serious consequences, and the resistance won't remain silent.
Among the demands, Palestinians call for the import of building materials required for the reconstruction of Gaza and the Qatari grant. Israel refuses all the Palestinian demands and links the reconstruction process in Gaza to political issues.
The Israeli regime has stopped the import of the required construction materials needed for factories that were damaged during the latest escalation. This has led to paralyzing the economy of Gaza. The Israeli regime thinks these attempts will break their willingness, but Palestinians will always support the resistance as the only means to defend their rights.
According to the Israeli army statement, the airstrike over Gaza won't stop as long as Palestinians keep firing incendiary balloons. Palestinian resistance expressed it's ready for all scenarios, including renewed fighting in the face of the Israeli inhumane acts.
The Israeli airstrikes reveal the true nature of the tension between Israeli regime and the Palestinian factions. There are many issues that need to be resolved, including reconstruction of Gaza. If Israeli regime keeps ignoring the Palestinian demands, we won't sit idle.
Palestinians here say the Israeli airstrike is an attempt to put pressure on resistant groups to give up on their demands. Palestinians also stress they will keep firing incendiary balloons until Israel lifts its crippling blockade and end restrictions imposed on the reconstruction of the war-ravaged Gaza. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. the supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless Thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of In the name of Allah, the best of the names, in the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O Patron of Beneficence.
In the limelight.
Not so incidentally, the $25 billion spending increase approved by the Senate Armed Services Committee exactly matches the cost to scale up COVID-19 vaccine production to meet global demand. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Jake Johnson, writer. This article is published under the heading, A Huge Outrage. Senate panel approves $25 billion Pentagon budget increase. Stay tuned for more. The Senate Armed Services Committee agreed recently to add $25 billion to President Joe Biden's already massive $715 billion Pentagon spending request, a move that prompted immediate outrage from progressive activists who have been demanding cuts to the bloated U.S. military budget. Just the proposed $25 billion increase to the Pentagon budget alone could end homelessness in the United States, making clear that senators are more interested in increasing the profits of military contractors than meeting the needs of everyday working people, said Carly Towne, co-director of the anti-war group Code Pink. Towne continued, while millions of Americans are steeped in debt, living paycheck to paycheck, facing eviction and struggling to pay medical bills amidst an ongoing health pandemic and recession, the Senate Armed Services Committee decided to hurl even more taxpayer dollars at an increasingly privatized for-profit war industry. Narrowly controlled by Democrats and chaired by hawkish Senator Jack Reed, the Senate panel voted 23-3 to approve $703 billion Pentagon budget for fiscal year 2022. The proposed Defense Department outlay is part of the sprawling National Defense Authorization Act, NDAA, which, if the Senate Armed Services Committee gets its way, will include the $777.9 billion in military spending for the coming fiscal year. Because of its role in setting defense policy, which determines subsidies and other rewards to private industry, the Senate Armed Services Committee is awash in cash from military contractors. According to Open Secrets, Reed's top contributors during the 2020 campaign cycle included Lockheed Martin and General Dynamics, two of the leading beneficiaries of federal contracts. Robert Weisman, president of the watchdog group Public Citizen, said in a statement recently that anyone who cares about our national security should oppose this increase in Pentagon spending and demand that the funds that would have gone to the Pentagon instead be allocated to global COVID-19 vaccine production or other human needs priorities. When the coronavirus has demonstrated that all the guns in the world can't protect our national security, when the U.S. spends more on its military than the next 11 nations combined, when we are withdrawing from Afghanistan and therefore reducing required military expenditures, when a Pentagon can't pass an audit, when a Pentagon continues to lavish funds on the F-35, which is 10 years behind the schedule, double the original price tag, and plagued by performance issues like engines that don't work, what possible justification is there for increasing the Pentagon budget over and above the increase already requested by the Biden administration? Weisman asked. Not so incidentally, he added. The $25 billion spending increase approved by the Senate Armed Services Committee exactly matches the cost to scale up COVID-19 vaccine production to meet global demand. In addition to money for the Pentagon, the Senate panel's proposed NDAA includes nearly $30 billion in funding for the Department of Energy, which manages the nation's nuclear stockpile. Just a day after more than 20 Democratic lawmakers demanded reductions in the United States nuclear arsenal, the Senate Armed Services Committee called for recapitalizing and modernizing the U.S. nuclear triad. The House and Senate must ultimately agree to identical legislation for the NDAA to become law. Given the narrow margins in both chambers, progressive members of Congress could credibly threaten to tank any bill that includes what they consider to be excessive funding for the Pentagon. In March, 50 House Democrats, led by Representatives Barbara Lee, Mark Perkin, and Jake Akey-Close, demanded cuts to Defense Department budget, arguing the money would be better spent on diplomacy, humanitarian aid, global public health, sustainability initiatives, and basic research. But Biden ignored the Democrats' call, requesting $715 billion for the Pentagon, an increase from the current $704 billion spending level approved under former President Donald Trump. Representative Ro Khanna was among the House Democrats who took Biden to task for proposing a larger Pentagon budget than his predecessor. "We need a fundamental shift in how we address national security issues and invest in climate action and pandemic response," Khanna, the deputy whip of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, said in April, adding, "Those are the issues impacting the security of the American people and will keep Americans safer than spending billions on more deadly weapons."
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Since mid-July, Cuba has seen a series of anti-government protests. The protesters say they are desperate, poor, hungry, and fed up with Havana's inability to meet their basic needs. Yet there are documents that show Washington is seriously embroiled in these rare events.
Folks, I want to start by recognizing the remarkable protests that are taking place in Cuba. The Cuban people demanding their freedom from an authoritarian regime. And I don't think we've seen anything like this protest in a long, long time, if quite frankly ever.
Everything began in the town of San Antonio de los Baños in the west of the country. The protest came after a power outage left the residents without electricity during the summer heat. They were then encouraged and even led by artists, especially hip-hop musicians, to take to the streets. Florida Senator Marco Rubio enthusiastically tweeted, "For those new to the issue of Cuba, the protests we are witnessing were started by artists, not politicians. Song, Patria y Vida, powerfully explains how young Cubans feel," referring to a track by Cuban rapper UTL. Similarly, the New York Times published an in-depth article about the song and the role it had in galvanizing the movement. But both the U.S. Senator and the U.S. Daily failed to mention Cuban rappers like UTL have long been on the payroll of the White House to sow discontent in Cuba. The latest grant publications of the National Endowment for Democracy, NED, which fund the CIA, show that the U.S. government is trying to get into the Cuban arts community so as to further its so-called regime change agenda in the Caribbean nation. In the words of Tracy Eaton, a journalist who runs the Cuba Money Project, the State Department, the U.S. Agency for International Development, and the U.S. Agency for Global Media have all financed programs to support Cuban artists, journalists, bloggers, and musicians, adding, "It's impossible to say how many U.S. tax dollars have gone toward these programs over the years, because details of many projects are kept secret." The hip-hop scene in particular has long been a target for American agencies like the NED and USAID for its biting critiques of Cuban society. Currently, a grant offer from USAID is offering $2 million worth of funding to groups that use culture to bring about social change in Cuba.
It would be great to see the United Nations step up and condemn that. I know that President Biden has spoken that they're trying to see what they can do to get the internet back up. That would be important. We're all doing whatever we can.
Meanwhile, the U.S. House Appropriations budget has also set aside up to $20 million for democracy programs in Cuba. Needless to say, any mention of democracy in Cuba is all but synonymous with regime change. But for what the Americans call a regime change, they have pinned their hopes on economic crises in the country, and they've done their best in this regard. As Professor Aviva Chomsky of Salem State University, author of A History of the Cuban Revolution, put it, "The U.S. embargo or blockade is one, not the only cause of Cuban's economic crisis. The U.S. has overtly and continuously said that the goal of the embargo is to destroy Cuba's economy so that the government will collapse." While it is not true to say that all those marching in the protests are on the pay list of the U.S., it is not also true to say that the protests are all due to internal problems. On some occasions, a number of demonstrators march underneath the U.S. flag, and the protests were immediately endorsed by Washington. Meanwhile, Florida Congressman Anthony Sabatini called for regime change on the island, tweeting, "High-ranking communist officials in Cuba should be given an ultimatum now. Either immediately assist in the transition of government away from communism or be prosecuted and executed thereafter. Hashtag SOS Cuba." At the same time, corporative media have shown great interest in covering the protests while constantly downplaying the effect of U.S. sanctions. For example, the Washington Post published a feature in favor of the protesters, claiming the Cuban president was reacting with predictable thuggishness, blaming everything on the United States and the U.S. trade embargo. That's while government documents openly state that the goal of the U.S. sanctions is to decrease monetary and real wages, to bring about hunger, desperation, and the overthrow of the government. Oddly enough, a great number of media outlets used images of pro-government movements to show the support scope of the anti-government protests.
The Guardian, Fox News, The Financial Times, NBC and Yahoo News all falsely claimed a picture of a large socialist gathering was, in fact, an anti-government demonstration. Meanwhile, Twitter has long shown enmity towards Havana. In 2019, the corporation suspended almost every Cuban state media account, in addition to those belonging to the Communist Party. That said, in 2010, USAID secretly created a Cuban social media app called Zunzunio, often described as Cuba's Twitter. The aim was to set up a platform to spew out Cubans' regime change propaganda and then direct them to protests, with the ultimate aim of fomenting a color-style revolution. Since the late 19th century, the Americans have always been trying to interfere in Cuba, either through invasion, occupation, or subversion. In 1961, they launched a failed invasion of the island. They reportedly attempted to kill Fidel Castro hundreds of times. Then they decided to focus mostly on blockade and economic war, a policy they've been pursuing for over six decades. They hope that economic misery will bring the nation to its knees, but so far the resistance of the Cuban people has dashed those hopes.
In the limelight. With only about half of Americans vaccinated, Dr. Anthony Fauci and other current and former health officials vigorously pressed the case on Sunday, 25th of July, that inoculations were the best way to stem a tide of new COVID cases. Dr. Anthony S. Fauci warned on Sunday, 25th of July, that the coronavirus pandemic is now going in the wrong direction in the United States because too many Americans are still choosing not to get vaccinated. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Pam Bellock, Azzy Pabera, Danielle Slotnick, and Jesus Jimenez. The piece is titled, It's Not Going to Be Good. Fauci sounds alarm over low vaccination rates fueling COVID surge. Please stay with us for more. With only about half of Americans vaccinated, Dr. Anthony Fauci and other current and former health officials vigorously pressed the case on Sunday, 25th of July, that inoculations were the best way to stem a tide of new COVID cases. Dr. Anthony Fauci warned on Sunday that the coronavirus pandemic is now going in the wrong direction in the United States because too many Americans are still choosing not to get vaccinated. Asked on CNN's State of the Union program, about projections in recent statistical models that COVID-19 cases and deaths could surge in the coming months if vaccination rates don't increase, Dr. Fauci said it's not going to be good. With about half of Americans not yet vaccinated and the fast-spreading Delta variant of the coronavirus circulating, Dr. Fauci and a range of current and former health officials expressed exasperation at the situation on Sunday, and vigorously pressed the case that vaccination is the best and most effective way to stem the tide of COVID cases. It is really a pandemic among the unvaccinated, Dr. Fauci said, adding, it's like you have two kinds of America. You have the very vulnerable unvaccinated part, and you have the really relatively protected vaccinated part. If you're vaccinated, you are in a very different category than someone who is not vaccinated. The situation is so dire that in recent days, even some Republican governors in low vaccination states have been pointedly exhorting people to get a COVID vaccine. On Sunday, 25th of July, on CNN, Governor Asa Hutchinson of Arkansas said. With the new school year on the horizon, this is a pivotal moment in our race against the COVID virus, adding that what's holding us back is a low vaccination rate. Governor Asa Hutchinson of Arkansas, a Republican, said he has been holding town hall recently, which he credited for a 40% increase in vaccination. Still, he added that certainly the resistance has hardened among some people. It's simply false information, he said. It's a myth. On CBS's Face the Nation, Dr. Jerome Adams, who was Surgeon General in the Trump administration, also encouraged vaccination, casting the decision in patriotic terms. Get vaccinated because it's going to help every single American enjoy the freedoms that we want to return to, he said. Dr. Jerome Adams said some people still have legitimate questions about getting vaccinated, including workers who worry post-vaccine side effects might cause them to miss a day's work or a paycheck. He predicted immunization rates would increase once the vaccines, currently available under emergency use authorization from the Food and Drug Administration, FDA, become fully licensed. That will likely prompt the military and some businesses to mandate vaccination for service members and employees, he said. In the meantime, Dr. Jerome Adams said the message should be, it is your choice, but choices come with consequences to you and to others, including children not yet old enough for vaccination and people who are medically vulnerable. Several current and former officials discussed whether recommendations or mandates for wearing face masks should be reinstated. Dr. Anthony Fauci said the Biden administration is considering reissuing stronger mask-wearing guidelines. In May, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention relaxed this guideline, saying that people who are fully vaccinated do not need to wear a face mask in most indoor settings. Dr. Jerome Adams said that guidance, quite frankly, has confused citizens. It's frustrated businesses and public health officials who I continue to hear from, and it's been, by any qualification, a failure. He said the Center for Disease Control, the CDC, should state clearly that even people who are vaccinated should wear face masks if they're in public, around people whose vaccination status is unclear, or in a community where COVID cases are increasing. The Center for Disease Control, the CDC, needs to give those businesses, those health officials, a little bit of cover by clarifying the guidance that they have out there, Dr. Jerome Adams said. Meanwhile, as a Delta variant of the coronavirus spreads through unvaccinated populations in the United States, many municipalities, colleges, and businesses are weighing not only whether to require vaccinations, but also whether to reimpose wearing of face masks indoors. Dr. Rochelle Walensky, the director of the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, said on Thursday, 22nd of July, that her agency had no plans to change the guidance it issued back in May. That guidance allowed localities leeway to make their own rules, but said that people who were fully vaccinated could shed their face mask in most situations. Many Americans, vaccinated or not, did so with relief. Now the highly contagious Delta variant of the coronavirus and the fear of breakthrough infections, however mild they usually are, have led many individuals to consider covering their faces again. Nationally, new cases, hospitalizations and deaths remain far below their winter peaks, but there have been steep rises in both cases and hospitalizations in some less vaccinated areas. Vaccines are effective against the worst outcomes of COVID-19, including cases caused by the Delta variant of the coronavirus. But the pace of inoculations has decreased more than 80% since mid-April, and less than half of the population of the United States is fully vaccinated, according to federal data. As a result, some cities are turning to wearing face masks as an additional precaution. Los Angeles County in California, one of the first places to reinstate a mask mandate, requires face masks to be worn in public indoor spaces regardless of vaccination status. Also in St. Louis, Missouri, announced a similar mask mandate on Friday, 23rd of July.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Dear brothers and sisters, welcome to Light Upon Light. These are the days of remembering the anniversary of the birth of Imam Al-Hadi alayhi salam, our beloved 10th Imam. And I am here with my brother Sheikh Muhammad. We were talking on the last show about some of the aspects of the life of Imam Al-Hadi, how he used agencies in his life, and how history hasn't talked a lot about Imam Al-Hadi because of the situation that Imam Al-Hadi alayhi salam was in. And one of the ways that he reached or talked or communicated with his Shias was by supplications, and one of them being Ziyaratul Jama'ah, one of the greatest supplications available, one of the best sources of knowledge to understand Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, to understand the meaning of being a Shia, a follower of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. Now, Shaykhna, you promised us we're going to dive into the ziyarah. So, brother, I'm going to give you the mic. First of all, I want to say assalamu alaikum and congratulations on the birth of Imam Al-Hadi.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you so very much for having me. This is a very great time. We should value it so much because it's going to be spent on the knowledge of Ahlul Bayt sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. Thank God for this blessing. Diving into the Ziyaratul Jama'ah. At first, like many other ziyarah, many other religious texts, we find it that it starts with salam. It says, As-salamu ala ahli bayt al-nubuwa. Wa mawda'a al-risala, wa mukhtalif al-malaika, wa ahbat al-wah, wa ma'adina al-rahma, wa khuzana al-ilm. It goes on and on. Previously, we talked about the amount of knowledge that we have towards Ahlul Bayt. How important is it? For example, Imam Baqir alayhi salam says that Imam Baqir alayhi salam says to his son Imam Sadiq salawatullah alayhi that ya bunayya i'raf manazil ash-shia ala qadri riwayatihim,
how much they report on narrations or they understand
on
narrations.
Yes, report and understand. So how much you you put time on these sayings of Ahlul Bayt, either first, if you want to narrate them, you should study them first, know them, leave them, and then narrate them. You know, when we go to the history, when we study the history of the narrators of Ahlul Bayt, we understand that they were so knowledgeable about these narrations. It was not like the fact that they received something like a book from their friend and they wrote it down and they passed it away. No, it's not like this. They were students in the class, they learned it from the teacher. And then if they wanted to be a narrator and pass it to the next generation, they had to go to the teacher to read the hadith, all of it to the teacher. First, the teacher read the text of the hadith, and then they read, they mashed it together. Only some of the students had the chance, they had the privilege to be narrators because they had to be smart students, very calculated students.
Not to put a lot of time as well.
Yes, not all of the person. No, it was a very strict kind of a channel or network. It was very safe. But moving on. So اعرف منازل الشيعة على قدر الروايات means the amount of time that you have put for learning from the speeches of Ahlul, from the words of Ahlul Bayt. How much narrations play in your life? What kind of a role do they have? How much of your knowledge do they consist? Right? Mm. This is very important. If Imam Bahar alayhi salam says to his son that if you want to know which of your follower is better, which one has a higher standing, look at the one that knows our hadith more. Mm. Right? So coming to here, this Ziyarat al-Jama is a great, very great source. Why all of it? The words of Imam Hadi salawatullah alayhi. And it tells us not about some, for example, let me say like this. We have different hadith from Ahlul Bayt talking about different topics, right? For example, you ask them, I want to get married. How should I get married? Imam alayhi salam says, for example, you should read this sentence, for example, khutbatul aqd. And then you can, you are married religiously and legitimately. Different questions can be asked, but some questions are more important because they give us more important and deeper knowledge.
They could be bases.
Yes, they could be basic questions. They were basic people, general people. They ask very normal questions and they receive the answers. Mm. But ziyarah is the word of Imam.
A fundamental for Shia beliefs.
Yeah, by his choice to teach the Shia.
So there was no one asking him. He started off right away.
Yes, he started off by himself initially. And this tells us about the depth of the ziyarah. So going through the lines, if I want to talk and explain about the ziyarah al-jama, it's so long, it's very much. But I choose some parts, some phrases, and which I think they tell us a lot. And we can contemplate on them. For instance, ma'adan al-rahma in the first line of the ziyarah. What does it mean? Like the mine of God's blessing. Ahlul Bayt are like a mine of God's blessing. When you hear a mine, what comes to your mind? What
a source.
A source. Good. For example, we're talking about a gold mine. Any sort of gold that is found outside comes from the mine.
And you're searching for gold, you go to this mine, for example.
Yes. What do we understand from this? That Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them, are the mines of God's blessing. Means any kind of blessing, any kind of gift, any kind of God's mercy that you find outside, means you find in the lives of other people. It has come from Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. Means if you have, start count your blessings, right? Mm. How many blessings you have?
Countless.
Count them, yes. From your body, from your talents, from your family.
Too many. Yeah.
Yes, too many. Any good thing that happens, it has started from Ahlul
Bayt.
Mind.
Yeah.
Yes, from that mind. When you think about this way, you understand much more about the connection that you have with Imam alayhi salam, about the love that Imam has towards you, about the things that he has bestowed upon you.
The emotional connection with
yes,
Imam.
Yes, the emotional connection becomes much stronger when you look at it this way, because Imam alayhi salam pictures it this way. It is the real picture. God, if God wants to give any kind of blessing to anyone, it is through the channel of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam.
Sheikh, we have to take a short break. I'm going to cut you off a little bit.
Thank you.
Brothers and sisters, we have to take a short break. We will be back, so please stay tuned on Light Upon Light. Again, we would like to congratulate you on this very, very happy day, the day of the birth of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, our beloved 10th Imam. So please, brothers and sisters, stay tuned so we can continue Ziyaratul Jama'ah.
The 10th of the 12 Shia Imams, Imam Ali al-Naqi, also called Hadi, was born on 15th of Dhul-Hijjah, 212 after Hijrah in Holy Medina. This holy Imam was at the helm of the Shia Muslim world at the young age of 8, just like his father, Imam Jawad, who had also become the Shia Imam at the same age. The life of Imam Hadi was coincident with a forceful wave of heretic thoughts in the Muslim community. In this era, it was a public belief that God has hand and legs and a body, and if anyone opposed this belief, he was called an unbeliever. In such an intense time, Imam Hadi taught the most profound notions of God's unity, Tawheed, to the Shia Muslims and protected this community from those deviant thoughts. The Abbasid caliphs were also aware of the significance of this event, and this led to more restrictions on the last imams. For this reason, Mutawakkil, the Abbasid ruler, summoned Imam Hadi from Medina to Samarra, where the imam was forced to settle in a military base. At that time, the Shias were scattered across the world, and the wide network of deputies was the only way to reach out to Imam Hadi. The residence of Imam Hadi in a military base had even made it more difficult and sometimes impossible for Shias to meet this holy imam in person. One of the greatest legacies of Imam Hadi is the numerous written prayers by this holy imam. These prayers contain the most profound and weighty Islamic beliefs and ethics in a simple language for the public. Furthermore, these prayers were commonly read by the people at the sacred shrines as an act of pilgrimage, which is a display of love and affection of the Shias towards their holy imams. Jama al-Kabira, one of the best written prayers in the hands of the Shia Muslims, is narrated from Imam Hadi. This prayer is a perfect manifest of beliefs for any Shia Muslim, almost addressing all aspects of Shia ideology such as God's unity, Tawheed, prophethood, imamet, and the resurrection day. This prayer is recommended to be read at the shrines of all imams. The Abbasid Caliphate always insisted to create a cynical view of the Shia Muslims and their holy infallible imams among the masses. Therefore, they sponsored a group of people